Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, April 9th, 2021. President Joe Biden sends to Congress a $1.5 trillion budget proposal for fiscal year 2022. It has a 16% increase in non-defense spending in areas such as transportation, health and human services, justice, and education. And for defense spending, a 1.7% increase. We'll have more on that coming up. White House COVID-19 response team turning down a request from some state governors for additional vaccine doses to deal with rises in caseloads. And it looks like Amazon's warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, will not be forming a union. The closely watched vote, still to be certified, was more than 2-1 against unionization. Flags flying at half-staff at Westminster Abbey in London as Britain mourns the death of Prince Philip, husband to Queen Elizabeth. President Biden calling the prince a heck of a guy, saying 99 years, he never slowed down at all. I admired the devil out of him. And we begin with some news about Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida. Politico reporting the House Ethics Committee on Friday opened an investigation into Matt Gaetz over an array of alleged lawbreaking and violations of House rules stemming from a federal sex trafficking inquiry. Among the alleged Gaetz improprieties that the Ethics Committee could examine are sexual misconduct, sharing inappropriate images in the Capitol, illegal drug use, and acceptance of bribes. Gaetz has sharply denied the allegations and suggested he's the victim of an extortion plot that negates the evidence against him. The Ethics Committee also opening an investigation into Republican Congressman Tom Reed of New York over allegations of sexual misconduct. You can read more at politico.com. And now to President Biden's budget proposal, $1.5 trillion, increases to domestic programs like education, public housing, climate change, and much more. Smaller increase, but an increase in defense spending. The president spoke to reporters at the start of an economic briefing in the White House Oval Office.
I sent to Congress my funding priorities for the appropriations process, including two key public health initiatives that I'm pushing. First is, like DARPA in the Defense Department, which was designed to develop and has developed breakthroughs to protect us and enhance our physical safety, I'm proposing a $6.5 billion appropriation for what we call ARPA-H, which is focused on focused on health issues. This is a pioneer breakthrough that we hope we can detect and treat and prevent diseases like Alzheimer's and diabetes and give us a chance to end cancer as we know it, because we'll focus exclusively on those items. And secondly, I'm proposing a historic funding increase of 50% of $4 billion to end the opioid crisis, which still ravages the country and has taken so many lives over the last 2 years. Resources of both the states and the tribes for treatment as well as prevention. It also includes the single largest funding increase ever for Title I schools for disadvantaged schools, to lift up the millions of children in low-income families. And it'll put them in a position where all the data is, I've talked a lot about this, the data shows that it puts a child from a household that is a lower-income household in a position, if they start school, not daycare, but school at 3 and 4 years old, there's overwhelming evidence that they were able to compete all the way through high school and beyond. And so it doubles the funding as well for VAWA services, including resources to end the rape kit backlog. We've been working this for a long, long time, and we still have a backlog in the rape kit. And the point is, a significant number of women who have been raped and the person has not been found or convicted is because they're sitting in jail. The average rapist rapes about 6 times. And so out there, we want to make sure we go through this backlog and find out to bring some certitude to for the woman saying, no, it was true. That's the man. He did it. And it changes the whole perspective, all the hearings we held on that. And also, there makes major investments in the fight against climate change. And there's issues that are personal to millions of Americans in the area of VAWA, because I get that asked and we get spoken to by everyone from mayors and governors, local officials of both parties. So I look forward to working with Congress to advance these and other priorities. I think we're going to be able to get, I'm hoping, we'll have some bipartisan support across the board. I've already spoken to some of my Republican colleagues about dealing with the infrastructure legislation we have up there, as well as other budget items. So we're going to work on seeing if we get some bipartisan support across the board here. But that's what we're about to do now. We're going to talk about our economic priorities and we get the brief from the team. Thank you all for coming.
President Biden in the Oval Office. And joining us now with more on his budget proposal is Neve Ellis, budget and appropriations reporter with The Hill. Thanks for being with us. A lot to digest today. Can you give us an overview of his proposal? What gets an increase, what gets cut, and what's new?
Yeah, absolutely. When we're looking at this proposal, the thing that stands out more than anything is just that the spending goes up significantly. Biden proposed basically $118 billion in additional spending over what our current spending levels are. And the lion's share of that goes to non-defense spending. So for the people that aren't budget nerds, discretionary spending, what Congress approves every year to keep the government running, is typically divided into defense and non-defense. Non-defense being everything else, transportation, education, health and human services, labor, anything that the government does outside of defense and outside of the mandatory programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So Biden is basically saying, I want a 16% increase in those programs, which is really, really significant. The other thing that sort of stands out is that defense, there's pressure from progressives to cut defense spending. That's something that Obama attempted to do when he was in office. Obviously, a very difficult thing to do in Washington. And the expectation was that defense would be basically frozen. It still got an increase of about $12 billion, 1.7%. Republicans are saying, hey, that's actually not even enough to keep up with inflation. That's not very good. But it was interesting to see that Biden still boosted it instead of keeping it flat or cutting it.
This is being called a skinny budget. What does that mean? And what's missing from it that will be detailed later?
Well, the thing that normally happens when an incoming administration proposes their budget is they release this skinnier blueprint that basically can kick off the process because it takes a long time for Congress to get all of its appropriations bills lined up. This budget is even skinnier than normal. He just has the overall spending levels that he's proposing for 2022. Normally, the budget proposal will include a 10-year budget window with kind of a spending path, maybe deficit goals, which essentially serve as a promise of where the country's sort of fiscal future is going, not to mention, how are we going to pay for it? Taxes, you know, is all of this stuff going to be financed through the deficit, or are we going to be increasing fees and taxes in order to make sure that doesn't happen? None of that's included. They also usually include proposals about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the mandatory side, the sort of automatic spending side of the government, and what their plans are for that. So none of that was included this time around. The administration says that they're going to have a more fully fleshed out proposal later in the spring.
You mentioned some of Republican and progressive Democrat reaction. Is there anything else that they might be objecting to in this budget?
Well, one of the things that stands out, of course, is that, you know, over the course of the Trump years, every year people look to see how much he was proposing for his wall along the southern border, which was very controversial, led to the longest shutdown in American history. Biden has proposed zero funding for that wall, which makes sense given his platform, and even went further in proposing that some of that whatever funding is left out there be clawed back. That's going to serve as a bit of a political issue for him, given the surge in migrants coming over the southern border. So that's something I can expect to hear a lot about in the coming weeks and months.
We're talking with Neve Ellis of The Hill. So just for people listening to this, they've heard in the past couple of weeks, we passed a $1.9 trillion COVID aid bill. There's a pending $2.25 trillion infrastructure bill. And now this, how does it all fit together?
So again, one of the things the administration is promising is that their sort of bigger, more fully fleshed out budget is going to fit all of those things together and put them into one sort of coherent whole. But I think the big thing that we can take away from this is that Biden is not interested in going small on anything. He's going big, he's going all the way, and he's not shying away from government spending. You know, we've come through several decades where the reigning ethos in Washington has been, you know, the government coming to spend too much or help too much is a problem. That sort of Ronald Reagan view that, you know, the scariest words are, I'm here from the government and I'm here to help. So Biden is turning the page on that and saying, no, we've got problems and we need the government to come in and fix them. And that's the main message that we're seeing through all of these bills, whether it's investing in infrastructure or whether it's boosting, you know, stimulus checks and payments for COVID relief, whether it's this proposal that he put out today, which is, you know, putting billions of dollars towards health and health research, increasing education funding. I mean, the Education Department is getting a 40% boost under this proposal. And basically saying that the thing that's going to make America thrive is this investment from the government.
Neve Ellis, budget and federal appropriations reporter with The Hill. Read more at thehill.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
From CNBC, Amazon on Friday secured enough votes to defeat the unionization drive at one of its Alabama warehouses, delivering a blow to organized labor who hoped to unionize a U.S. Amazon facility for the first time. There were, opposing the union, 1,798 votes, and in favor, 738 votes. Margin of victory larger than the approximately 500 challenged ballots, which would have been tallied only if they'd swayed the outcome of the election. Some reaction from the White House and Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The president has said that whether to organize a union is a worker's choice. And the National Labor Relations Board has a process for ensuring there is an accurate count of the votes cast in selection so that we can know what choice the workers have made. So the president is going to wait, just for your own planning, for the NLRB to finish its process and declare a result to make a further comment. But I will say broadly, as you know, and you alluded to in your question, we know it's very difficult for workers to make the choice to form a union. That's why the president's American Jobs Plan includes the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which would give more workers the ability to organize and bargain collectively with their employees. And that's a fundamental priority for him, something he's fought for throughout his career. But we will wait for further comment until the NLRB concludes their analysis.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. The union that organized the vote in Alabama says it plans to challenge the results, accusing Amazon of unfair labor practices, and says Amazon, quote, left no stone unturned in its efforts to gaslight its own employees. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 297, NASDAQ up 70, S&P up 31. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg joined the White House briefing today to advocate for the president's over $2 trillion infrastructure spending proposal and the accompanying corporate tax rate increases, the latest in a string of cabinet secretaries to do so this week. Buttigieg also responded to a lawsuit filed by Florida over federal coronavirus-related restrictions on the cruise line industry. We'll hear from the secretary in a moment, but first, here is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday in Miami.
I'm happy to announce that on behalf of the tens of thousands of Floridians whose livelihood depends on the viability of an open cruise industry, today Florida's fighting back. We're filing a lawsuit against the federal government and the CDC demanding that our cruise ships be reopened immediately. This will be something that we believe we have every legal right to insist upon. We don't believe the federal government has the right to mothball a major industry for over a year based on very little evidence and very little data. And I think we have a good chance for success.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday. This week, Royal Caribbean announced it'll be resuming operations, but in the Bahamas. Carnival Cruise Line also threatening to pull all its ships out of U.S. ports. A reporter's question to the U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg today at the White House.
Have you been in touch with the CDC about that industry's concerns? And to cruise industry leaders who say we should be treated more like the airlines, what would you say?
Well, the bottom line is safety, right? And we look, I'm the Secretary of Transportation. I can't wait for us all to be on the move as much as possible in a safe and responsible way. But it's got to be safe and responsible. And airplanes have one safety profile. Cruise ships have another. Vehicles have another. And each one needs to be treated based on what's safe for that sector. I'll tell you, I certainly care a lot about seeing the cruise sector thrive. And I know that CDC is hopeful that a lot of these operators will be in a position to be sailing by midsummer. And laying out these specific kind of gates that they need to get through is a very important step toward that.
And to the industry leaders who say midsummer is too late, to the governors who say that's too late from our state economies, you would say what?
We want to do this as soon as we responsibly can, but we also have to make sure that it's safe.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg in the White House briefing room. The CDC has issued technical instructions for cruise ship COVID safety, but no specific date for cruise lines to return to full operations in the United States. The White House saying that as of today, more than 112 million Americans have received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine, and more than 66 million are fully vaccinated. That's more than a quarter of all adults in the country. Some state governors are seeing or worried about spikes in cases and calling on the federal government to send more vaccines their way, including Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer and New Jersey's Phil Murphy. Governor Whitmer held a news conference in Lansing.
But the variants in Michigan that we are facing right now won't be contained if we don't ramp up vaccinations as soon as possible. We need additional supply of the one-shot J&J vaccine, which we believe is vital to our strategy of rapidly distributing vaccines and slowing the rise of spread. From public health research, we know that the one-shot vaccine is critical to protect younger Michiganders or those who may have difficulty getting back for a second shot. We've been speaking with the administration in Washington, D.C. regularly over the last few days and will continue to do so. Because anyone who looks at a COVID map knows Michigan is unquestionably a national hotspot right now. My team and I have been in regular conversation with the National COVID Response Team, and we have asked for more vaccines. I'm grateful for what they have offered: therapeutics, additional personnel, mobile testing, and vaccination units. But I am concerned because I believe, as do a number of public health experts, that we really should be surging vaccines to states that are experiencing serious outbreaks.
Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The White House COVID-19 Response Team Coordinator Jeff Zients saying at a briefing today, additional vaccine doses will not be sent to Michigan or other states requesting them.
You know, this pandemic has hit every state and every county hard. Thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people have died, and more are dying each day. And there are tens of millions of people across the country in each and every state and county who have not yet been vaccinated. And the fair and equitable way to distribute the vaccine is based on the adult population by state, tribe, and territory. That's how it's been done, and we will continue to do so. The virus is unpredictable. We don't know where the next increase in cases could occur. And you know that we push out all vaccine as soon as it's available. And we're not even halfway through our vaccination program. So now is not the time to change course on vaccine allocation. We're going to stick with the allocation system of allocating by state adult population. That said, it is a challenging situation in many states, and we want to do all we can to help those states. And that's why we're working with states to make sure that every dose that they do receive is administered as efficiently and equitably as possible. We'll also send more federal personnel to help with getting needles in arms and other aspects of fighting the pandemic. We're increasing testing, both diagnostic testing and screening testing, sending those resources to states who have increases in cases. And then, as I talked about earlier, we'll also make more therapeutics and treatments available. This is all in the context of we've delivered 90 million doses across the last 3 weeks, and we'll continue to get doses out to states, tribes, and territories and through our federal channels as soon as they're made available.
Jeff Zients at today's White House COVID-19 response team briefing. You can find the full briefing at our archive at cspan.org. An update on the global distribution of coronavirus vaccines from the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He expressed concern today that most of the doses so far administered have been given to wealthy countries.
Out of 220 countries and economies, 194 have now started vaccination and 26 have not. Of those, 7 have received vaccines and could start, and a further 5 countries should receive their vaccines in the coming days. That leaves 14 countries who have not yet begun vaccination for a range of reasons. Some have not requested vaccines through COVAX, some are not yet ready, and some plan to start in the coming weeks and months. COVAX has now delivered more than 38 million doses of vaccine to more than 100 countries and economies in the past 6 weeks. We are encouraged that almost all countries who want to start have now started. However, I emphasize the word start. Most countries do not have anywhere near enough vaccines to cover all health workers or all at-risk groups, never mind the rest of their populations. There remains a shocking imbalance in the global distribution of vaccines. More than 700 million vaccine doses have been administered globally, but over 87% have gone to high-income or upper-middle-income countries, while low-income countries have received just 0.2%. On average, in high-income countries, almost 1 in 4 people has received a vaccine. In low-income countries, it's 1 in more than 500. Let me repeat that. 1 in 4 versus 1 in 500. COVAX had been expecting to distribute almost 100 million doses by the end of March. But due to a marked reduction in supply, we have only been able to distribute 38 million doses. We hope to be able to catch up during April and May.
Dr. Tedros is the head of the WHO World Health Organization news conference in Geneva. That 38 million COVID-19 vaccine doses that he mentioned that have been distributed worldwide, that is enough to vaccinate 0.25% of the global population. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. President Biden signing an executive order creating a commission to study whether to add seats to the U.S. Supreme Court. The commission will be chaired by former White House counsel Bob Bauer and Christina Rodriguez, a former deputy assistant attorney general, now a law school professor at Yale. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin ordering immediate actions to address the threat of extremism in the military. They include standardizing questionnaires to screen recruits and new procedures for veterans to report extremist activities after they leave the service. And the White House's Southern Border Coordinator, Roberta Jacobson, tells the New York Times that she'll resign at the end of the month. This comes during a surge of migrants crossing the border, including unaccompanied minors. The Minneapolis Star Tribune writes the medical examiner who did the autopsy on George Floyd began testifying in the Derek Chauvin murder trial after multiple experts gave differing reasons for what led to the death late last spring at the hands of police. Dr. Andrew Baker ruled that Floyd's cause of death on May 25th in Minneapolis was cardiopulmonary arrest complicating law enforcement subdual restraint and neck compression. Baker did not include a lack of oxygen, a cause that 3 medical expert witnesses firmly said was what killed Floyd after he was pinned on his stomach under the now-fired Chauvin's knee for more than 9 minutes. That all from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Here's some of Dr. Baker's testimony. Questions from Jerry Blackwell, Minnesota Special Assistant Attorney General.
Dr. Baker, we did find from the toxicology amounts of fentanyl and methamphetamine in the results from the lab.
That is correct.
You didn't mention either fentanyl or meth in Mr. Floyd's system. You mentioned those, but you don't list either of them on the top line as causes of death. Why is that?
Well, the top line of the cause of death is really what you think is the most important thing that precipitated the death. Other things that you think played a role in the death but were not direct causes get relegated to what's known as the other significant conditions part of the death certificate. So the other significant conditions are things that played a role in the death but didn't directly cause the death. So, for example, you know, Mr. Floyd's use of fentanyl did not cause the subdual or neck restraint. His heart disease did not cause the subdual or the neck restraint.
All right. So these are items that may have contributed but weren't the direct cause.
Correct.
Dr. Andrew Baker, Hennepin County, Minnesota Chief Medical Examiner. Also testifying today, Dr. Lindsay Thomas, another medical examiner who had worked with Dr. Andrew Baker on the staff. She ruled out illegal drugs as a cause of George Floyd's death, something the defense attorney had been pointing to.
Dr. Thomas, a few things I'd like to try to clarify with you.
Thank you.
You were asked a number of questions that were to the effect that if we take the police subdual restraint and neck compression out of this, what would you conclude Mr. Floyd's cause of death to be? Remember those questions?
Oh, yes.
Aren't those questions a lot like asking Mrs. Lincoln, if we take John Wilkes Booth out of this, may I finish? It's my analogy.
That's argumentative.
Dr. Thomas, if we put the police subdual compression and neck compression into this, restraint and neck compression into this, what was the cause, the manner of death for Mr. George Floyd?
The cause of death was the law enforcement subdual restraint and compression, and the manner of death is homicide.
Does it make any sense to you whatsoever from the standpoint of trying to assess cause and manner of death for Mr. Floyd to be answering questions having to do with hypothetically taking the facts of this case out relating to his subdual restraint and neck compression?
You can finish the question.
Dr. Thomas, from your standpoint as a forensic pathologist and your analysis of manner and cause of death, would you ever approach an assessment of manner and cause of death by taking out of it the facts that you found relevant and highly pertinent to assessing and determining the manner and cause of death?
No.
And in this case, those factors are what?
The law enforcement subdual restraint and compression.
And you were asked questions again about fentanyl and meth. Remember those questions?
Yes.
Do you know what quantity of meth was even involved or found in Mr. Floyd's bloodstream?
I have the number.
Well, let me ask you a question.
But it was very small. I mean, I do know that.
Dr. Lindsay Thomas, questioned by a member of the prosecution team, Jerry Blackwell, at the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, as they wrap up week number 2 of testimony. If you missed any of it, C-SPAN 2 TV is replaying each day's proceedings at 8 p.m. Eastern. Buckingham Palace in London releasing a statement today, reading, "It is with deep sorrow that Her Majesty the Queen has announced the death of her beloved husband, His Royal Highness the Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. His Royal Highness passed away peacefully this morning at Windsor Castle. Prince Philip was 99 years old. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke outside the Prime Minister's residence, 10 Downing Street.
Like the expert carriage driver that he was, he helped to steer the royal family and the monarchy so that it remains an institution indisputably vital to the balance and happiness of our national life. He was an environmentalist and a champion of the natural world, long before it was fashionable. With his Duke of Edinburgh Award scheme, he shaped and inspired the lives of countless young people. And at literally tens of thousands of events, he fostered their hopes and encouraged their ambitions. We remember the Duke for all of this, and above all, for his steadfast support for Her Majesty the Queen. Not just as her consort, by her side every day of her reign, but as her husband, her strength and stay of more than 70 years. And it is to Her Majesty and her family that our nation's thoughts must turn today, because they have lost not just a much-loved and highly respected public figure, but a devoted husband and a proud and loving father, grandfather, and in recent years, great-grandfather.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in London. At the White House in Washington, President Joe Biden expressing his condolences and admiration for the late prince.
Joe and I and the entire administration send our condolences to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II on the loss of Prince Philip. He was a heck of a guy. His lifetime of service to the United Kingdom and the whole Commonwealth was visible to everybody for a long, long time. And his bravery serving in World War II, as well as his being a champion of the environment, as well as the charitable things he set up. So we really do express our condolences for an extraordinary life that was led by the prince. And I think he's going to be missed, particularly in the United Kingdom. But 99 years old, he never slowed down at all, and which I admire the devil out of.
President Joe Biden in the White House Oval Office. Queen Elizabeth will now pause royal duties as she, the royal family, and the United Kingdom observe a period of mourning that could last up to a month. Plans for state funerals in Britain are always on standby, but this time likely will be altered for Prince Philip due to the coronavirus pandemic. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere, anytime. And remember, this program can be had as podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Hope you have a good night and weekend.